Sorry for the technical difficulties. No, it's my fault. I should have had the laptop out and ready. So when I'm listening to Bart talk about cryptography, I always have this feeling of, yeah, things are going pretty well. I mean, there's all these cool things that cryptographers have put together. Maybe there's 50 different things that you can do wrong, so that's why it's important to hire a cryptographer and make sure that you're avoiding all those things you're doing wrong. But basically, everything's working well. I mean, cryptography is delivering all these wonderful things, and as long as you avoid these 50 mistakes, then everything's going to be basically okay. That's the nice sugar-coated version of cryptography. I have a more realistic attitude about cryptography. I'd like to show you some examples of what cryptography is actually like in the real world. These will be examples which are mostly about internet cryptography, which I'm most familiar with, but I'll occasionally mention some other things. And I'm going to try to dive into a few of the examples. I think if you watch a bunch of car crashes, then you get some idea, yeah, it's pretty bad, and maybe some idea, oh yeah, this is clearly why that crash happened. But if you really want to appreciate how badly people screwed things up, then you have to dive into the details, look at the wreckage, and see what actually happened. So if you'd like to peek at the same slides online, then go to cr.yp.to/talks.html down to the bottom, and you'll find this one along with the afternoon one. Okay, what cryptography is promising is the usual security criteria: confidentiality, integrity, availability. I'm a firm believer in these traditional criteria. I agree with Bart that there's refinements of notions like integrity into different types of authentication, but I think the basic classification works quite well. What cryptography is promising different from security, it's only looking at these types of security against some eavesdropper, Eve. So you're supposed to imagine Alice and Bob, and I guess I have to clarify that Alice is maybe my computer and Bob is maybe a web server. It's maybe not the humans that are talking, but in cryptography we talk about these Alice and Bob as being the entities that are communicating. Eve, for this entire talk, is somebody evil. You're supposed to imagine like a double agent working for the Chinese government and the movie industry, somebody who obviously nobody likes. That is Eve. Now, Alice and Bob are the good people, or the good computers, and cryptography is telling Alice and Bob, we will give you security against this eavesdropper, Eve. Of course, if Eve is actually breaking into your web browser through buffer overflows, cryptography won't do anything about that. But if what Eve is doing is monitoring network packets and forging network packets without being clever enough to do any buffer overflows or cross-site scripting or anything, then that's what cryptography protects against. Confidentiality says that the spies are not going to understand the data going through the network. Integrity says that the spy, even forging packets, is not going to be able to corrupt any packets, add new packets, change anything that you're seeing. Availability means that Eve won't be able to destroy your connections, won't be able to destroy your data. The difference between integrity and availability is that if Eve manages to stop the right data from getting through, but doesn't fool you, you know that the right data isn't getting through, you know there should be the right data and you're not getting it, that's an availability problem, it's not an integrity problem. If Eve manages to change the right data and show you the wrong data and you don't realize it, then that's an integrity problem. Plus, it's also an availability problem. So if you have availability, you also have integrity. Okay, so those are the basic criteria, and that's what cryptography says it's going to do for us. But the reality is that cryptography actually fails again and again and again to accomplish these things. So I'm going to show you examples where confidentiality is failing, where integrity is failing, and where availability is failing. And some of those examples I'll dive into in some detail. The most fun examples are the ones where somebody puts in some cryptography, and as a result of that, the attacks actually get easier. So cryptography, maybe it makes some attacks harder, but it makes other attacks easier at the same time. Maybe it'll help integrity, but make your availability much, much worse, or it'll make your confidentiality much, much worse. I'll give some examples of that. There's also some times when cryptography is a marketing stunt. A lot of times, look, there are a lot of times when people put in cryptography to try to make security better. But there are a lot of times when people are putting in cryptography to make the users think that things are better. Is it more important for the web to be secure, or is it more important for users to think the web is secure so that they do their credit card purchases online? It's not clear, and there are people on both sides of that issue. Cryptography, well, I put deliberately in question marks because it's not always clear that people are aiming for the marketing side of cryptography to try to convince users that things are okay. A lot of times people are really going for the actual security, not the marketing side of it. But whether or not it's deliberate, a lot of times cryptography makes users think that the internet or whatever other communication is secure. And then they do stupid things. They do things that they would not have done otherwise. So attacks become even easier because the users, for instance, are transmitting data that they would not have transmitted if they'd known how bad the security actually is. First example, a lot of times cryptography is designed to protect against blind attackers and just completely fails as soon as the attacker is actually sniffing the network, is actually watching what's going on the network. People will often think this is good enough. Oh, the attacker isn't actually watching the network, right? I mean, the attacker is, I've read some academic papers, and there's these students at these universities who were carrying out these blind attacks. So that's what I'm thinking about, is blind attacks. And then people set up security mechanisms against those students, like, okay, the browser has a cookie, typical user authentication cookie. A cookie, people will often describe it as the server is encrypting some data for itself. But it's not encryption, it's authentication. Maybe it's also encryption to keep it secret. But what really matters for user cookies is that they're authenticated. The server is saying, here are some account credentials, which if you show them to me again, I can recognize that, yes, those are credentials that I have signed or somehow said, yes, those are from me. So the server will recognize the cookie, and somehow the browser gets the cookie, maybe through HTTPS, some secure connection. The browser has these account credentials from the server, and then sends them back to the server through HTTP. Everybody knows this failure mode for cookies, that if they're something which the server is looking at and saying, yeah, if I see that cookie, I'll know that I'm talking to the right user, the person who I've given that cookie to before. Well, if you send the cookie through HTTP, Eve is watching the connection and then can replay the cookie. And that's exactly what happened with FireSheep, which was my initial picture on the first slide, was a screenshot from FireSheep, which end of 2010 was making quite a splash by stealing Twitter credentials, Facebook credentials, and so on. So, of course, the eavesdropper is sniffing the network. If you just protect yourself against blind attackers, then you don't end up protecting yourself against attackers who are actually working to sniff the network. Maybe your academic students, again, as my example of not serious attackers, maybe they're doing blind attacks a lot of the time and exploring what can be done with blind attacks. But the serious attacker is breaking into millions of computers, and then one of those computers is on your network and sniffing your connection. Or maybe the serious attacker is right next to you. All right. Next example, similar kind of absurdity that somebody could imagine that this is secure, but, well, people keep saying it. Cryptography designed to protect against passive attackers, attackers who are only sniffing and not forging packets. People will think, oh, yeah, what's the chance that the attacker is actually forging packets? Now, some people say, it's kind of hard to forge a packet, right? And other people will say it's trivial to forge a packet. Let me give you examples of this. First of all, the security mechanisms, TCP, the original security mechanism in TCP, stopping somebody from forging a TCP connection, is TCP would check the IP address that your packets are from. Now, if somebody's just sniffing a connection and seeing, or just knows your IP address, and then tries faking a connection from your IP address to break the old RSH protocol or lots of other protocols that rely on this, then, well, TCP would look at the IP address. The attacker who doesn't forge packets is stuck with his IP address. But the attacker who forges packets can make any IP address he wants and trivially breaks this. DNS, same thing. TCP crypt. This is a very recent example of something which is sounding like cryptography. It is cryptography in some sense. It's just very bad cryptography. What TCP crypt does is, well, here's a quote from the manual. The manual says, look at this TCP dump output. TCP dump is your standard sniffing tool, which convinces a lot of people that sniffing is easy. It doesn't forge packets, which is what makes some people think forging packets is hard. Compare this TCP dump output, which appears encrypted, it is actually encrypted, with the clear text packets you would see without TCP crypt running. Active attacks are much harder, as they require listening and modifying network traffic. As soon as you modify network traffic, you flip one bit, and TCP crypt is completely disabled, completely non-functional. So Eve, sniffing the network and forging packets, completely breaks TCP crypt. It provides no security at all. But TCP crypt says that's much harder because you have to modify network traffic. I don't know where people get the idea that modifying network traffic is hard. There's these huge examples of people systematically modifying network traffic. It's not just something that is being done by casual attackers. It's being done by everyday attackers. It's being done by huge US corporations that are selling their gear to huge companies and governments. For instance, Bluecoat was reported a few months ago to have sold their internet blocking gear, which is actually quite sophisticated and quite expensive. They didn't sell it to Syria, but they acknowledged that Syria had a bunch of their interception devices. Now, these are things which are meant for controlling an entire internet connection. These devices will monitor and block whatever the person who has this device wants on your internet connection. So if your internet service provider has Bluecoat gear and decides that you're no longer allowed to make connections to Twitter, to take a Syrian example, then they just flip some bit in the Bluecoat device. And well, Syria apparently got their hands on some of this gear. Bluecoat says, no, we definitely didn't sell it to Syria. We know they have it because Syria didn't turn off the reporting back to us that here's where the device is, and so we could track the packets. Oh, yeah, it's in Syria. We're sure that we only sold those devices to trustworthy governments like the US and Iraq. And we have no idea how out of these 14 devices that we sold to Iraq, why we're only getting reports from one of them in Iraq and 13 of them in Syria. How could that possibly have happened? Another example, if you think it's just governments who are systematically modifying network traffic, TrustWave. How many people heard about this TrustWave incident? To me, it's kind of shocking that something like this could happen. I mean, when I heard rumors that something like this could be happening, I thought, this is completely ridiculous. I mean, it's such a violation of what we promise to users of what cryptography is doing for the web. But TrustWave has admitted it now. So TrustWave is an SSL certificate authority. You heard that there's something more than 500 certificate authorities that are built into your browser, whether it's Firefox or Internet Explorer. TrustWave is one of the certificate authorities that has the authority to tell your browser, this is a certificate for any website. Now, TrustWave sold an HTTPS interception box. What does this box do? This box contains TrustWave's power in one machine. They have a lot of those machines that they use to sign certificates for people. So if you convince TrustWave, I am Google.com, then they will sign a certificate saying, yes, okay, you are Google.com, here's your public key. We, as a certificate authority, assure all the browsers in the world that your public key for Google.com is this. They built a box which does that automatically with no checking at all for every website. And they sold it to a company. And the company installed it on their network. Now, TrustWave says, we're sure that the box, they couldn't have gotten our signing keys for all SSL sites out of that box. We built it very carefully, can't possibly get any secrets out of it. It's secure hardware. And we're also sure that they installed it on their own network. And they couldn't possibly have routed anybody else's traffic through it. They were only doing it for innocent purposes of monitoring what their employees were doing on HTTPS websites, not for anything really serious. So I think that what certificate authorities are promising to do is actually check something. Well, we've heard that they don't check a whole lot, even with extended validation, they only check a little bit. But here, just flagrantly violating the idea that a certificate authority is actually checking that your website is somehow connected, your certificate is public key is somehow connected to you. They have this box which just automatically signs for every site. Incredible. Well, they were talking about removing trust from the name. there was some discussion for about a week after they admitted this of kicking them out of the browser. And then the eventual conclusion was because they had come forward instead of being caught, that they would not be kicked out of the browser. So your browser still trusts TrustWave. It's all good. The questions of trust are something which I'm focusing on the cryptographic issues and TrustWave is interesting for many reasons. What I want to emphasize here is that people are modifying network packets, even systematically, even to break SSL. It's not something which is just something hard to do. It's not something which is just an imaginary attack. People are constantly modifying network traffic. All right. Something I'd like to dive into in more detail is cryptography, which is designed just to protect integrity and then ends up messing up confidentiality and availability. Whether it actually achieves integrity, that'll be a side issue for the moment. The problem here, what people think is, okay, we're protecting integrity, so great, that's it, that's the end of the story. And sometimes they'll admit, yeah, we're not doing anything about availability, we're not doing anything about confidentiality, but what amazes me is that a lot of the time they make availability worse, they make confidentiality worse. I'd like to dive into DNSSEC as an example of that. DNSSEC is signing DNS records. DNS, the domain name system for looking up, say, google.com has address 192.whatever, no, probably not 192, but whatever their address is. DNS will tell you here's the address of google.com. DNSSEC is a project for adding signatures to that data, so you can actually check. Here's a little bit of history of DNSSEC being deployed on the internet. In 1993, the Internet Engineering Task Force started designing DNSSEC. And after a whole lot of time with nothing really happening, in 2008, according to the news stories, Dan Kaminsky said, there's a big problem with DNS, it's not secure, and here's a partial fix, but we really need DNSSEC. And so as a result of this announcement, maybe some people had pointed this out before, but Dan Kaminsky did a great job of making people understand that this was really a problem. So 2008, suddenly people understand that DNS is something where attackers can forge data. And this attracted attention to DNSSEC. Within a year, there were 941 IP addresses worldwide that were DNSSEC services, servers, providing some number of DNSSEC names. It can be a lot of names on one server. Maybe it wasn't exactly 941 computers. These days, people tend not to have two public IP addresses on one computer, but it can be that there's several computers with one IP address. Any casting then could be more than 1,000 computers. And then after another year, end of 2010, I think this is what they call exponential growth, from 941 to 2,536 computers around the world, maybe even more computers, 2,536 IP addresses running DNSSEC. After this, I was kind of surprised that the exponential growth didn't continue. December 2011, 3,393. It's maybe a little disappointing if you're expecting another doubling every year. But I've heard the internet is running out of IP addresses for DNSSEC servers in particular, so maybe it's not such a surprise. Okay, what exactly do these DNSSEC servers actually do? Well, if you look at the advertising, then DNSSEC says, we are protecting the integrity of the internet. We are hardening the internet, the impact and importance of DNSSEC. But actually, DNSSEC is much more functional as an attack tool. So I'd like to show you what you can do with DNSSEC as an amplification tool. DNSSEC is the easiest way to take down websites. Not just the websites that are running DNSSEC. DNSSEC is this, you can fly it anywhere you want and take down any website you want. Not by blowing it up. I mean, there's other ways to take down websites. But DNSSEC, you can do it through pure software. In fact, through a few little shell scripts that I'll show you. So let's take a look at the DNSSEC data. I won't show you all the data, but I'll show you the scripts which produce the data. And maybe I should pause now to see, so how many people here are Unix, Linux users, people who would look at the shell scripts? And okay, some people, not everybody. So just to go through the important features here, there's a website, sexspider.cs.ucla.edu, which for several years has been monitoring DNSSEC usage, and you can just download all the data. You can also, I mean, you can do what they do, but it's easier to download from them, like for the SSL Observatory. Well, Bart was mentioning it's some work to collect all the SSL certificates on the internet. It's certainly easier to just download it from somebody who has a database. Once you've downloaded it, which takes a little while, then you look at that directory and say, okay, green, green, green in some format in whatever files you've downloaded, zone files, from SexSpider. The green, green, green means that you have DNSSEC. They've established that DNSSEC is working on some particular server. Now, at the end of this, there's a sort and a word count, and that will tell you, okay, how the sort minus U is only unique addresses of these servers, and that'll tell you how many DNSSEC servers there are. That's what gives numbers like the 2,000 and 3,000 I was saying before. Now, you can process the data a little more. So here's, again, looking for green, 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 and then some information about the zones that are being served by these servers. You can make a list of, OK, here's servers. If you track through this what the 1 and 2 are, then you'll see, OK, there's some IP addresses and names of DNSSEC protected names. And this script makes a list in this file, servers file, of here's all the DNSSEC protected names. Now, DNSSEC being just integrity-aware cryptography and not caring about things like availability, DNSSEC takes incoming packets, which are asking questions about data, and puts signatures into the responses, and actually typically several signatures in the responses. And they're kind of big signatures. So you have a small packet coming into a server, and there's a response which has lots of cryptographic information. Must be really secure when you see lots of hex digits on your screen. And this script is looking at how big that information is without processing the cryptographic information, just looking at the sizes of it. So what this does, reads through the IP addresses and the zone names from this file, the server's file, and makes a new file, AMP, which is, okay, for each of the names and IP addresses, DIG is doing a DNS lookup. It's sending a packet through the network and saying, okay, I'd like DNSSEC information about this name, any information that's available about the name. Ignore, well, if there's various failures, don't worry about it. Try once for 1 second. And then whatever the results are, process a bit and figure out the size. This $5 is the number of bytes in the DNS response. And 22 plus, that's accounting for overhead of a UDP packet, divided by the length of a query is 40 bytes plus the length of the name. This est is an estimate, a pretty good estimate, for the amplification factor, how much extra traffic is coming from the server if you send this query into the server. And then put a list of that into this AMP file. And then finally, just sort this list of amplification factors, discarding any amplification factors below 30. If you do this, then you have a file maxamp, which finally has 2,326 lines. I was trying yesterday to update this, because I realized this was from back in December 2010, and there were only 2,600 DNSSEC servers at that point, of which 2,300 had response sizes more than 30 times the request size. For instance, .fi, if you ask this particular IP address for DNSSEC information, give me some big RSA signatures about .fi. And it says, sure, here they are. And it gives you something which is almost 100 times bigger than the input that you sent. That's the biggest one from December 2010. They've actually cleaned it up a little bit, so now it's only 94 times bigger than the query. There's, I think, .lu is higher up now. Well, I was trying to update this, see if it was over 3,000. Actually, before the script finished, I was optimistically saying more than 3,000. I'm not quite sure because the internet was cutting out a little bit. When you send 100,000 packets overnight, it doesn't quite finish in time. Oh, well. I wasn't trying to flood the servers. I was just doing one at a time. From back in 2010, into 2010, what these scripts were claiming is that there's 2,326 IP addresses of DNSSEC servers which will give amplification factors of at least 30. Now, if you're going to make a claim like this, then you should double check whether it's actually true. So let's check. Let's see what happens. Here's a script on the next slide where you have to plug in some IP addresses of a sending machine, which will send a little bit of traffic, and a receiving machine, which will receive the much bigger cryptographic information for your security. You have to plug in the IP addresses of those, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, 6, 7, 8. On both machines, you should watch how much traffic is going out with, say, TCP dump. And this little script says, okay, on whichever machine, this one is the receiving machine, well, set up 5, 6, 7, 8 as an extra address for the machine. You probably don't want to do this on addresses that you actually care about. Then read through the list of estimated amplification factors. And for each one, just try same dig command. It has a convenient minus B to say, please set my IP address for the outgoing request to the following. I'm sorry. This is on the sender machine that you do this. So on the sender machine, which has address 1, 2, 3, 4, the sender adds an address for 5, 6, 7, 8. You're allowed to do this as a running as root. You can set up an IP address on your machine. And the sender machine, well, it's happy to say I also have 5678 as an address. And then this dig will send packets which say they are coming from 5678. Then that goes out to the network. The parenthetical comment about egress filters here says there's a few networks out there that will notice that you're doing this kind of thing and stop your packets from going out. So use some other network, of which most of the internet doesn't have egress filters. You send out packets which have a return address of the receiving machine. With the same try once for 1 second, just send one packet from this maxamp list, and then see how much data comes into the receiving machine. And so I tried exactly this and got 51 times amplification when there were only 2,000-something DNSSEC servers. Now that there's 3,000-something, I guess the amplification factor should go up because I can pick more higher amplification machines. So this means if you send 10 megabits per second, for example, I was sending a little less than that, but if you send 10 megabits per second, then you can get all these 2,000 computers on your behalf to send 500 megabits per second to whatever target you want, your test machine, to whatever test machine you want. Most sites can't handle 500 megabits per second of traffic. The network operators start sending around email on various mailing lists, say, the North American Network Operator Group, it looks like there's some denial of service attack, we just lost the following websites, panic, panic, and then they start to try to identify where the traffic is coming from, and several hours later, maybe they've taken your test machines down, but then you try some more machines. 200 megabits per second, you need quite a few machines to have 200 megabits per second of internet connectivity. If you're talking home computers, each with, say, 4 or 8 megabits per second, then you need to break into a few of those before you get up to 200 megabits per second. And this is still within the limits of what these 2,000 servers that I checked can handle. 200 megabits per second, trying one server at a time, it's happy to send its fraction of the 10 gigabit per second flood. I didn't try doing a 10 gigabit per second flood to my test machines. But anybody can do this, and there are not many sites on the internet that can handle 10 gigabits per second of traffic. So this is a security solution. It's supposed to be doing something to improve security. And as a result of this, the more people who install it, the bigger floods you get, the less availability you get, not just for DNS, but for everything. There's an announcement by Anonymous that they're going to take down the root servers in a few weeks. And then there's another announcement by Anonymous saying that, no, that's not us, really. But, okay, this still would not take down the root servers. But there's a lot of critical servers that this would take down. This is astonishing that somebody could deploy a security solution which has this kind of impact. Now, if you look at the specification, DNSSEC says, the DNSSEC RFC says, DNSSEC provides no protection against denial of service attacks. Now, I read something like that, and I think, yeah, okay, they're admitting that they're not caring about a problem. But that's different from saying, by the way, we're making the problem much, much worse. The reality is that DNSSEC is the worst distributed denial of service amplifier on the internet. There are quite a few different things which will amplify packets by a factor of 3 or 5. But DNSSEC is the only thing that will amplify traffic by a factor of 50. That's security for you. Now, there's lots and lots of other denial of service attacks. I could go on for a while about some interesting denial of service problems, but let me not get totally caught up in that one issue. Let me move on to confidentiality, still about DNSSEC. Now, if they say they don't care about availability, and they're making availability much, much worse, and they also say that they don't care about confidentiality, and they elaborate on this saying, we're not encrypting queries, your queries are public, we're not encrypting responses, the responses are public. If they say that, then you might be worried, are they making confidentiality much, much worse? And in some ways, they actually are. DNSSEC takes DNS data stored in what are supposed to be private databases and just publishes it. Now, this is weird. I mean, you can imagine it's sort of intuitive that if you have big signatures, huge RSA signatures, and lots of them being added to some data, hold certificate chains and negative signatures, whatever. I'll get into some of the details in a bit. You can imagine that, yeah, you're getting much bigger responses, and if you're not careful, that can be an amplifier. That's something which doesn't require any explanation. But this damage of confidentiality of DNS databases, this is weird. This is something you would not expect until you look at what DNSSEC is actually doing. Examples, there's acadmedpod.org.br. This is a domain name that was registered by the Medical Academy of, I forget what the PA is for, but somewhere in Brazil. Now, it's not online. They registered it and obviously didn't figure out what to do with it. Maybe they'll make it live at some point. Maybe they'll decide it's better to get acadmedpod.org without the .br. Or maybe they want some different name. But, you know, somebody who sees this name might say, ha-ha, I can make some money by registering acadmedpod.org, and then I bet they're going to want that name too. There's millions and millions of names which are not public information. And this is just one of the huge number of names that have been leaked by DNSSEC. So why does DNSSEC give away private information? Well, let's look at the DNSSEC data flow. What does DNSSEC do to give you signatures on DNS data? Let's imagine that KU Leuven is signing its DNS data. They're not, but suppose that they were. Then DNSSEC says the administrator at the university signs DNS data and puts those signatures into the DNS database. This is pre-computation. It's something that happens before there's network interaction with the database. Very simple assumption about the data flow, that you're going to pre-compute signatures. It sounds kind of innocent, but the consequences are incredible. What happens, first of all, if you have data that's changing? Obviously, it's hard to pre-compute signatures if you don't know what the responses are going to be. Well, DNSSEC says that's not our problem. DNS data is supposed to be static. Answers to everything are static. If you want to change your data, do that slowly. Go into a back room onto your secure computer and sign the new data. You shouldn't be generating answers on the fly in microseconds. Okay. What if you have DNS data that's old, DNS data that is changing slowly on, well, for instance, you move your IP address. You start from one IP address and your network operator says, oh, sorry, we're going to have to reorganize the IP addresses because, well, we're trying to save IP addresses, so we're going to have to move you over here, better for the IP allocation. And, well, you move your IP addresses. And then you have to change your DNS data to point to the new IP addresses. Now, an attacker, maybe, can grab the old address if it's available and then replay old signatures saying that your site is at that old address. You've signed that old data, and now you've signed some new data, but is the old signature still valid? Can Eve tell somebody you're at that old site, which Eve now controls? Can Eve replay that signed data, and somebody will trust it? Well, DNSSEC is more serious about addressing this problem. DNSSEC says there's going to be an expiration time in every signature, which could be months, could be days. This causes problems for administrators, so we'll see the security consequences in just a moment. In general, it seems if you're constantly re-signing stuff, then people end up messing it up. As Bart was saying, if you're only changing keys, changing whatever every 2 years, then you forget how to do it. If you're changing every week, then things also go wrong. You don't forget how to do it, but there's just you're not watching carefully. It's all the time. You get used to it working, and then something breaks. For instance, DNSSEC users in 2010 on September 2nd were unable to reach anything in .us because DNSSEC, they knew through the DNSSEC public key distribution mechanisms that .us has DNSSEC information, and they're not supposed to trust any non-signed .us information. That's what it means to run DNSSEC. You're protecting yourself against unsigned data. .us, signatures expired. .be, a month later, signatures expired. I could go on and on with these examples. Let me give you most recent examples that I've seen. ISC is the Internet Software Consortium. They're the people who distribute the main DNS software that supports DNSSEC. Bind is distributed by ISC. They're the main people who've implemented all the test versions of DNSSEC, pushed the specifications, and they let some names expire accidentally and posted some long explanation of, oops, yeah, here's what the scripts were supposed to do, blah, 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 blah. Somebody on the same mailing list said, last night I was unable to check the weather forecast because weather.gov broke their DNSSEC. Of course, if you don't use DNSSEC and you don't bother checking whether there's signatures, then you just accept the unsigned data, everything works fine. But these were people who were checking DNSSEC signatures and couldn't reach weather.gov. The response from ISC a week ago was, you know, we have this option. Well, you can read what this says. So say goodbye to the security against replays of old information. All right, this still doesn't explain how DNSSEC leaks information. But here's the critical question you should ask about pre-computed signatures. What if somebody's asking about data where they want to get signed responses back, but the data doesn't exist? Now, it might seem like this doesn't matter, but it really does matter. First of all, obviously, the administrator can't just sign every possible name. I mean, somebody could ask about xyzzy.kuleuven.be. Now, the administrator is not going to have signed something about xyzzy and every other possible name. I mean, this is insane to imagine generating a huge database of all possible strings, all possible signatures on non-existent data. So the most obvious thing to do is just sign the existing data. Say if there's information that exists, like www.kuleuven.be, then you sign that record. But if something doesn't exist, of course you don't sign it. And it sounds quite reasonable. It's the first thing that comes to mind, but it doesn't work. Let's see what happens if you follow this policy. User asks you about a name that doesn't exist, xyzzy.kuleuven.be. And then the user gets back an unsigned answer because you don't have signatures on it. And I mean, that's how the system is supposed to work according to this policy, is that there are only signatures on existing data, not on non-existent data. So the user gets back an unsigned answer saying there's no name, and that's how non-existent names are supposed to work. So the user can't wait for a signature. There is no signature. So the user assumes the name doesn't exist, which it doesn't. But what if it actually does exist? So the user asks for www.google.com and gets an unsigned answer. Let's suppose Google's using DNSSEC. Then the user gets an unsigned answer, which is not actually correct. It's a forgery. Eve has said www.google.com doesn't exist. Now, this is indistinguishable from this other situation. The user's gotten an unsigned answer saying the name doesn't exist. So the user trusts that information. www.google.com doesn't exist. Your browser fires up a page saying, sorry, can't find google.com, please try again later. Now, obviously this is denying service. It can be an integrity failure. This is really a question of what you know about the name that you're looking up. If you know that Google exists. You look at www.google.com, your browser says that doesn't exist, you know something's wrong with the network, you'll try again later. You won't believe what your browser is telling you. You won't believe that Google has gone away. But maybe you're looking up a name. There's all sorts of times when software is looking up names, and if it sees the name does exist, it does one thing. If it sees the name doesn't exist, it makes a different decision, does something else, and it actually believes the information. And in that case, there's a violation of integrity. If you're getting bad information and you believe it, that's an integrity violation. If you're getting bad information and you don't believe it, you know that it's bad, that's an availability violation. The potential of this being an integrity violation was enough for the DNSSEC designers to say, no, we can't do this. We have to protect against somebody sending unsigned information saying names don't exist. So what they originally deployed, called NSSEC, negative signatures, was the following. That's kind of clever, actually. What they said was, if you have a non-existent name at, say, nonexistent.clegg.com, then what DNSSEC gives back is a response which is signed, pre-computed signature, saying there's no names between this name that does exist and this other name that does exist. And you can try this. This is legitimate data. There is a nick.clegg.com. There is a start.clegg.com. And if you ask about any name between nick and start, then you'll get back this same signed data. And then you can see, aha, okay, it's signed, first of all. Check the signature. And you can see the name you asked about is between nick and start. And so, okay, you know that that name doesn't exist. You've got a signature. Solve the integrity problem so somebody can't fake this data saying names don't exist. But now you can also see how information is getting leaked. If you send, there's not many names in Clegg.com, send a few dozen queries, then you get all of the names in Clegg.com, and you're not just seeing the names, but you're convinced you have signatures guaranteeing that you've got the complete list of names. So if there's 30 names, you do 30 queries to give yourself complete confidence that you've got all 30 of those names. Complete information leak of the Clegg.com information. Now, for some years, DNSSEC design documents were saying, it's part of the design philosophy of the DNS that the data in it is public. This is an exact quote. After about 10 years of saying this and saying, oh, it's just fine to leak this information, DNSSEC switched strategy. 2008, finally, there was an attempt to stop this information leak called NSSEC3. If you're having a problem, apply more cryptography. That'll fix it. So here's NSSEC3. You have a one-way hash function, SHA-1, with some extra stuff, tweaking SHA-1. Maybe it's SHA-1 repeated 3 times or 30 times with some salt tossed in. It's some function that anybody can compute. And then instead of revealing the nick.clegg.com and start.clegg.com, you reveal hashes. So instead of saying the name you've asked about is between these names that exist, you say the hash of the name that you've asked about, with this public hash that anybody can check, is between these two hashes. So a signed response will say there's no names with hashes between blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. And then you check, you've asked about a name, you compute the hash yourself and see, aha, it is between these two hashes. And I've got a signature saying there's nothing between those two hashes. So great, I know this name does not exist. And then along with this application of more cryptography, there's a marketing part of NSSEC3, which is to pretend that this solves the problem, to pretend that there's no longer information being leaked here, that this NSSEC3 is less damaging to confidentiality than NSSEC. So for instance, ISC says NSSEC3 does not allow enumeration of the zone. Does anybody see what's wrong with this? You do have to know all the inputs, but that is something public. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to verify the signature. So everything you need to compute the hash, everything that any user around the internet would need to check that you have a non-existent name, everybody has to be able to compute the hash. And the server gives away everything that somebody needs, like how many SHA-1 iterations there are, what extra strings get tossed into it. So it does work in the sense that you can compute, anybody can compute the hash, anybody can check the signature, but it still leaks information. And the reason for that is that cryptographers use names like one way. And it means something different from what you think it means. It doesn't actually mean the function is one way. A one-way hash function, if it's a good one, like any of the SHA-3 finalists, a one-way hash function, even SHA-1 in this context, is good enough cryptographically to make cryptographers think, yeah, okay, it's as far as we know, it's one way. But that does not mean that you can't invert it. It does not mean that you can't figure out these hashes that you get. It doesn't mean that you can't figure out what the names were. What one way means is if somebody has a big random string and then they hash it, then you can't go back and figure out the random string. But names are not big random strings. Maybe occasionally they are, but your normal DNS names are going to be something which is eventually guessable. It's not something which would make a cryptographer say, oh, that's a secret which can be protected by applying a one-way hash to it. So one-way doesn't mean what you might think one-way means. So what the attacker actually does is figures out all the hashes by just sending a bunch of queries and seeing all the different hashes that show up, and then guesses what the names are. Maybe there's a Nick. I'll compute the hash of Nick. Maybe there's a start. Maybe there's a Chrysalis, whatever names it might come to mind. Okay, just try all these different names and then hash each one with the same function and see if any of the hashes match the dot, dot, dot. This works really, really quickly. If you try this out, then there's a lot of names that are guessable instantly. They're really short. And then there's a lot of names which take longer to guess, but it's still much, much faster to guess this way than to try sending to the server. This is the official DNSSEC response to this. You could have just, if you're going to guess names, you could have asked the server, hey, do you have a nick.clegg.com? Do you have a start.clegg.com? This is not really a confidentiality leak. It's public information, because you could ask the server about it. But the speed of the attack is an incredible difference. If you're flooding a server with 4 megabits per second, your typical small site will have that kind of internet connection, then you've got maybe 500 million guesses per day, depending on the exact packet length. And of course, the administrator can see what you're doing. Versus, suppose you download all the hashes from NSSEC3, and then you try guessing on your own computer. And you have one PC with a couple of graphics cards, and you can do more than a million guesses per day. And the administrator has no idea. You've done legitimate queries and gotten back some hashes. There's nothing nothing weird about it. And then on the side, you use your computer and do an incredible number of guesses. And if you have more computers, then you do far more silent guesses per day. So the speed of violating the privacy of whatever names might be private on the server, it's much, much faster and undetectable thanks to NSEC3. All right. Let me keep kicking DNSSEC, but in a different way. So cryptography, people have these wonderful intentions and end up, because they're protecting integrity, they end up hurting confidentiality, hurting availability. But what's really depressing is when they actually aren't even protecting integrity. So let's look at what DNSSEC actually accomplishes. There's an idea that people have that they've put cryptography somewhere, so great, problem solved, whatever the problem is. They're cryptographically protecting something. Let's call it X. The question that you have to ask is, what exactly is this X? The goal at the beginning was to protect the communication from Alice to Bob, protect that against the eavesdropper, Eve. Well, is X the communication from Alice to Bob? Is it the complete communication from Alice to Bob? Is it all the way from Alice? Is it all the way to Bob? Almost always the answer to this question, the combined question at least, is no. For example, a lot of times your X is not getting through to Bob. Suppose you've got DNSSEC installed, and then user, Bob, pulls out his Android phone, looks at Alice's web page. Now, the phone is going to use its DHCP-provided information of where the local DNS cache is, which is, say, a hotel, and the phone is going to ask that hotel DNS cache, hey, where is whatever Alice's web server is? And the cache provides information back to the phone. And now the cache is where DNSSEC is installed. Nobody's installed DNSSEC on a smartphone. Eve has not forged the response going to the cache. Eve has forged the response going to the smartphone. Eve is somebody on the wireless network between the smartphone and the hotel access point, and Eve is just forging data to the smartphone. So there's DNSSEC, which is maybe protecting information to the DNS cache, but not protecting information all the way to Bob, well, Bob's smartphone at least. A lot of times, instead of X not reaching Bob, the problem is that X is not actually the data from Alice. Well, maybe X is some sort of data from Alice, but let's look at an example, one of the big announcements recently, .org deploying DNSSEC. What they said, this is the sort of thing that people say to make press releases, .org becomes the first open top-level domain to sign their zone with DNSSEC. Significant milestone, bolster online security, first open, blah, 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 successfully sign our zone with DNSSEC. We're the largest domain registry to implement this needed security needed security measure. This registry has, I don't know how many millions of domain names, second-level names, something.org. Now, let's look at what .org actually signed with DNSSEC. I asked .org yesterday about Wikipedia.org. And you would think if .org is signing something, Wikipedia might be a good example. And here's exactly what they sent back, translated into English. What .org signed was something saying, there might be names with hashes between blah and blah. This is a variation of NSEC3 that you're using. There might be names in this range. I checked at this point, Wikipedia.org, if you hash it, does have a hash in this range. So they are talking about Wikipedia.org and anything else in that range. And .org says, as part of the signed statement, that they have not signed any of the names that might exist in that range. Now, outside the signature, they say, by the way, the Wikipedia.org name server is the following. This is what it means for .org to have deployed DNS security. They have signed something. Apparently, there's a few. You can see from the gap between H9 and HH, they probably have a few hundred signatures of different names in .org. And then millions and millions of names where all they're signing is something saying, sorry, we haven't signed that, if we have that at all. But by the way, here's the name servers. Now, how exactly is this different in security from sending no signatures at all? Another example. You've got X maybe being data going all the way to Bob, maybe it's Alice's data, but it's not all of Alice's data. And this is where you can really see DNSSEC going wrong. Everything so far, you can imagine how within the DNSSEC model, it could be fixed. I mean, they just have to do more signatures. Maybe there's too much load for them to do more than a few hundred signatures out of a few million. But here's the big problem with DNSSEC. Suppose X is the address of a server, like Alice's web server. And then there's a signature on that information from DNSSEC. This is what DNSSEC wants to do, is sign your server addresses. Alice is not sending just her server address to Bob. The communication from Alice to Bob is a web page or an email message. It's something human comprehensible or at least computer comprehensible, which is not just some server address. The server address is routing information on the way to this. So X, the information which is being signed, is fundamentally different from what Alice is actually trying to transmit. Given this difference, you have to ask what security is actually being provided for Alice and for Bob. Alice can, of course, go beyond DNSSEC and say, okay, I'm going to do DNSSEC and use SSL, use HTTPS, and then my web server is protecting its data, providing some encryption, some authentication. But what does DNSSEC do if Alice is using HTTPS? If Alice is using HTTPS, then she's got some signatures on the actual data that Bob is getting. Bob can check those signatures. Well, okay, it's authentication of the data, and there's signatures on the public key, and there's several levels of the system. But point is, HTTPS protects the actual communication. DNSSEC is signing some routing information on the way to getting that information. But if Alice has protection of the actual web pages, then why does she need protection of the routing information? There's an answer to this from the DNSSEC specifications and a lot of mailing list discussions. And this is something where it's hard to say that I disagree with this concept, saying Alice is unable to trust her servers. Alice can maybe trust her laptop, but that's not her web server. Her web server is online all the time. Somebody's broken into it. Alice can't trust that. She can trust her laptop, which is never online. No problem there, really. The idea in DNSSEC is you've got this guarded room, somebody with a machine gun in front of the room, and there's a secure computer inside this vault, and then DNSSEC pre-computes signatures on those offline computers with the guards. Nobody can break into those. And then the actual web servers, DNSSEC doesn't trust those because it has signatures from the secure computer. And even if somebody breaks into the server, they can't forge the signature from the guarded machine in this vault. But even though DNSSEC is arguably accomplishing some extra security for its signatures in this way, it's still signing the wrong information. It's not actually providing security for the web page, for the email. If Alice uses DNSSEC and doesn't use anything else, Eve is free to forge Alice's web pages and everything else Alice is communicating. Alice's servers are still free to forge Alice's web pages. Even if Alice has DNSSEC and HTTPS, then Alice's servers are still free to forge Alice's web pages. DNSSEC says, we'll guarantee you get to that server. And then the server says, yep, here's the web page, which has been forged by the server. If Alice uses PGP on some guarded machine on her laptop and that's secure then and signs data, then she can work around this and actually sign her web pages in a way that her web servers can't break. But again, DNSSEC doesn't do anything in that case. I've asked this question to many DNSSEC proponents. Whether you have HTTPS or not, whether you have PGP or not, give me a situation where here's an attack on the communication from Alice to Bob where DNSSEC stops that attack. And I've gotten no answer. It seems like a very basic question to ask about deploying some cryptography is, okay, what does it do? What attack does it stop? And for DNSSEC, the answer is nothing. All right. Enough beating up on DNSSEC. Let me, in my remaining time, tell you about some other internet protocols like SSL and SSH and so on, which are certainly not paragons of security. One of the most fun cryptographic problems is variable time cryptography. I'd like to give you an example to illustrate this. The general problem is that people think, okay, there's cryptographic functions where those functions are taking the input and then there's some computation which is totally scrambling the input, giving an output where nobody can understand what that output is, unless they have some secret key. It sounds great, and then there's all sorts of people who will look for patterns in the output and then say, oh yeah, I could, if you had only half as much computation, I could break that, but that's way too much. And you get hundreds and hundreds of people saying, yeah, I'm unable to break that. So you really think the attacker cannot see any patterns in the output. Sounds great. Except the attacker is also seeing more information, the time that it takes. The attacker sends a packet to a server, and then the response with some cryptography comes back. How much time did that take? The attacker often, not always, but often sees the time that it takes for Alice to encrypt the plain text, produce a ciphertext, and the time it takes for Bob to take the ciphertext and compute the plain text. Now, this timing information often is going to make the cryptography much, much easier to break. Let me give you an example, which is the shift cipher. For example, the Caesar cipher. So the shift cipher, you take each letter of your plain text and you move it along by k positions. It's a very bad cipher, but we'll see, even for this very bad cipher, it becomes even worse when you look at timing. So k is your secret key, 1 through whatever. For instance, Caesar used this for a key of 3, and maybe not with quite the same alphabet. There were only 22 letters in ancient Latin, but anyway. If you encrypt hello, which I guess was also not Latin, with Caesar, use Caesar's key. Move H along, I, J, K. Okay, K. Then E turns into F, G, H. L turns into M, N, O. L turns into O again. O turns into P, Q, R. Okay, not too hard to do. Now, I've got a key of 1. This is a faster key. I, F, M, M, P. I didn't even need to pause on the letters there. I mean, just move each letter forward by 1. Okay, I'll give you an exercise of a slower key. 13. So you can go do that at home. So you can see from these examples that the amount of time you're taking to encrypt something depends very much on what your key is. Now, if you look at the ciphertext like KHOOR, then you just try all the different keys, or you say, oh, repeated letter, it's probably a repeated E, or whatever. There's lots of ways to, oops, it's not a repeated E, it's a repeated L. Okay, maybe you have to try a few possibilities for the key. It's certainly not a good cipher for many reasons. So you can break it very, very quickly. Even more complicated versions of that standard thing to break in your head. But if you look at timing, it's even weaker. I mean, timing is something where from the timing here, you see how fast, I mean, I'm secretly writing my plain text and ciphertext, and you see how fast I get it done, and obviously my key was 1. Or I took a little bit longer, my key was 2, a little longer, key was 3. And maybe it's not perfect information, but it narrows down the key much, much more than just looking at the output. Now, this is not an artifact of this particularly simple cipher. It's something which happens for even the most modern crypto systems we have. Much, much stronger outputs, much harder to find any patterns in. But we still have these timing problems. We still have variations in the time it takes, depending on the key, and that's leaking so much information that people are able to figure out what the secret key is. Password examples are often not thought of as cryptography, but one of the classic attacks, which I think of as a variable time cryptography attack, was checking a password. Now, passwords are, I was criticizing before, as cryptography against blind attackers. If somebody's watching the password, then of course they break the system. But nevertheless, they're used in situations where you don't think that somebody's watching the connection. In the 10x operating system, there was a comparison for the password where they would take, you type in a password of AAA, and the actual password is secret, and then 10x would compare A versus S. Oh, that's different, so the password is not right. Sorry, try logging in again. And then you try BAA and CAA, and you eventually get to SAA, and then the S matches, and then 10x compares the A to the E, and that takes longer. And then by trying 26 guesses for the first letter, 26 for the next, okay, maybe not just uppercase letters, but by a very small number of tries, can get a password of any length from the timing information. Now, you might say, wait a minute, it can't possibly have been this easy. First of all, watching the time that a computer takes, it's a fast computer. Even in the 1970s, this was probably running on a computer at more than a megahertz, and it's not easy to time something that accurately. You're going to get noise in your timings, especially if you're a user watching the screen. And there's some answers to this. First of all, kind of generic answer, which I don't like, is saying, well, Yeah, there is noise, but you know, are you sure how much a difference the noise makes? You want to be sure about your crypto systems, and if there's noise and you think that stuff's an attack, maybe I don't particularly like this answer saying whether there's an attack or not. What gives me confidence that there is an attack is, first of all, you try the timings again and again, and you eliminate the noise statistically. And this works. You get the noise down to something negligible. You try the same password again and again and again, and then you filter out independent noise, and you just get the actual time for the password comparison. But actually, there's something else, which was what the attackers did to break 10x passwords, which is that they made the timing signal bigger by having the secret password and the password they were comparing to stored, they were able to control this, stored crossing a page break in memory. And then the machine would, if it just read before the page break, then it would be fast. If it went to the next page, it would have a page fault, slowing down quite a lot. And that made the timing signal much, much bigger and made it very easy to filter out the noise and find the passwords. Now, these kinds of techniques have been developed in many, many papers. Some serious cryptographic examples. Paul Kocher, in 1996, took an RSA library, RSA Ref, the official RSA library, from the RSA company, and timed it for all sorts of different plain texts for various keys, and was able to compute from the timings what the keys were. The basic thing going on here is RSA is doing all this arithmetic on big numbers, and if the numbers were a little smaller at some point, then that would speed up the computations. And then Kocher was able to figure out what the pattern of processing of the numbers was from the pattern of numbers being smaller, which he could see because it was correlated with timings. Now, this wasn't an attack on an actual system because he was running a test program which was capturing a timing, running RSA ref, and then capturing another time, see how fast it was. But Bonnet and Brumley in 2003 were through a network, an Ethernet, but still a real network, maybe not wide area, but they were extracting OpenSSL RSA keys. Now, OpenSSL is one of the standard packages used for not every web server in the world. Microsoft has their own SSL software, which forked from Eric Young's stuff many years ago. But OpenSSL is the package which is used for a lot of web servers on the internet. I think Apache also has their own. But there's certainly a lot of web servers using OpenSSL. And the RSA keys inside OpenSSL were visible from timing information. Just try sending requests to this web server, look at the results, and see how long they took. And that was enough to figure out the RSA keys very quickly. Amazing failure of cryptography. Much more recent example, Brumley and Tuveri got, in minutes, an OpenSSL ECDSA key through the network. I'll give you another exercise here. This one's a little harder than the move hello along by 13. IPsec, for many years, has used the memcomp function to check whether an authenticator on a packet matches what it's supposed to match. Sounds very much like the 10x example. So the exercise is to forge IPsec packets using the timing variability in memcomp. Watch how long it takes for the server to respond, whether it's accepting your forgery or not, and see from that how many bytes of the authenticator are matching. Clearly, if you look at the code, the examples that I'm talking about are, you have some code which says, if some condition is true, then do something, otherwise don't do something, and you have a loop where the number of times through the loop depends on some secret data. That's going to leak the condition, whether it's true or false, into your timing information. But there's more leaks to worry about. If you're trying to write correct code, which is constant time, then you start seeing more issues, like, you have an array index. You look up x bracket I. Then a lot of information about I is going to be leaked into your timing. Because there's caching. Some parts of the x array are in cache. Some other parts aren't. There's store to load forwarding. There's all sorts of things a processor does to try to speed up your access to x bracket I. And those have different effects for different values of I, different effects that affect your timing. Usually, if you're watching the total time for encryption, you get a good correlation between any of these individual timing leaks and your total encryption time, and you can filter out all the different timing leaks that are happening, and that's what people write papers about, is extracting secret keys out of this information. Or people will grab more information than just the total encryption time. because the cache inside your CPU, the branch predictor inside your CPU, those are being affected by the dot, dot, dots here. It's not just the total encryption time that's being affected, but everything running on the machine has its timing affected by what's happening inside your cryptography. These secrets are leaking in all sorts of ways that are not controlled by memory protection between processes, not controlled by virtual machines. You can have completely separate virtual machines where somebody has a process in one virtual machine whose timings are affected by cryptography running in another virtual machine. And then they can extract, even without seeing the ciphertext, even without seeing the timings from the encryption, from their own timings, they can figure out your cryptographic data. What I'm saying might sound like, seriously, could this actually be done? But there's a 2012 paper doing exactly that. AES is the advanced encryption standard. This is, cryptography best practices use AES, along with various other things that have been endorsed by cryptographers. But AES, if you want the software for AES to run quickly, which people do, then they need table lookups. There's lots of X bracket I's, where X is some big array inside the software, and I is some secret data. You can't make AES go quickly on most CPUs without doing this. I actually extracted AES keys this way in 2005. People had figured out before this for a while that there was a potential problem, but nobody had actually gone through actually doing it. So I sat down and actually did it. And at the same time, Osvik and Shamir and Tromer actually did it using one of these more severe information leaks. They used a hyper-threaded CPU where they could have another thread running almost at the same time as the thread which was doing cryptography. And in 65 milliseconds, they were also targeting a real application. I was doing a sort of lab experiment. They were taking the Linux disk encryption device and extracting the AES key that was used on it. So I've got on my laptop, my disk is encrypted, and now if somebody runs on this laptop with this AES software, which is thankfully not the software in use, but if somebody runs any program on that laptop and they know what they're doing and they look at the timings of their own program with no privileges at all, then they can see the AES key being used for encryption. In this case, 65 milliseconds. Lots and lots of papers trying to protect against these attacks. Lots and lots of papers breaking the countermeasures. Yeah.
Yep. The next project is, but okay, if timing is so critical, maybe you could mess up with the timing in the machine to sort of simulate more computation.
You have to watch out for the correlation. So if you just add random noise, the attacker just tries, he's going to get random noise from the network probably anyway if he's doing a remote attack. The attacker just tries again and again and then averages the signals and gets rid of the random noise. You can do something which is not random. You can try to invert the correlation. So you could try to pump up the total encryption time to some constant amount. And if you're careful to make sure there's no interrupts during the encryption, you can actually do that. And it's not too hard inside the operating system kernel to make the total encryption time constant. But that doesn't stop these kinds of attacks. So if you have information being leaked into the branch unit, into the cache, and that's affecting other processes, you're not going to make those run in constant time. And those can see their own timings. So if you just look at the total encryption time, then yeah, there's some reasonable defenses against this, which still allow you to do things like X bracket I and if I, where I is the secret. But if you look at these more advanced attacks, which are looking at the timing of other processes on the same machine, then it's awfully hard to protect against. The only solution I know, I'm not trying to be constructive until this afternoon, but the only solution I know is to not do this and not do that. And that's kind of tough, but it can be done. Okay, I have a few more examples. Last little comment about these timing and so on attacks. There's much more than timing. And if you talk to hardware people about the information that they can get out of cryptographic devices, and they'll say, oh yeah, timing, haha, you software people, that's all you can figure out about a computer. We can hear what's going on inside your CPU from meters away just by listening to, it's kind of tough through audio or video, but radio. I mean, this is kind of the electromagnetic version of videotaping when you're typing in your PIN. Okay, your CPU is maybe not broadcasting its data through video, but It is broadcasting what it's doing through radio. And there's tons and tons of attacks along these lines. There's a conference, a cryptographic hardware and embedded systems, CHES conference series, going for 15 years, which has hundreds of papers on these kinds of attacks and trying to stop them. If somebody's close by your cryptographic device, then you can almost give up hope. It's really, really tough to protect your secrets. Bard and some students and some other people had a paper in 2007 saying that Keylock, this is a root system for cars and garage doors and so on, they said, okay, we can do a computation, they actually did it, which given 1 hour of ciphertext from constantly interrogating one of these garage doors, for instance, given 1 hour of ciphertext, we can figure out the key and then forge the root device. Okay, that's pretty cool for cryptographic attacks, a cipher failing somehow. But it's nowhere near as damaging as this power consumption attack, where these hardware people were looking at the power consumption from one of these garage door devices. And by measuring it very carefully and making some intelligent guesses about what was going on inside and then doing a lot of computations and cryptanalysis of the power results, by measuring the power, they figured out the master secret for the whole system, the manufacturer key for the whole system, which was supposed to be securely embedded inside this device in a way that nobody could figure out. And as a result of that, knowing the master secret, you're going root twice, and they will find your key. So much more devastating attack using the extra information that's provided by your hardware. I've just been talking about the software timing, but there's much more damaging side channels that people get information, cryptographic keys out of. And then imagine what it's like for non-cryptographic secret information, users' private information, where people might not even think about these issues at all. Of course, it gets completely leaked. All right, another kind of worst practices cryptography is decrypting unauthenticated data. Now, I'm not talking here about what Bart mentioned about encryption and authentication is you have to do encryption and authentication. I mean, maybe you don't need encryption, but you certainly need authentication. Of course, you should never have encryption by itself. Now, a lot of people are going to say, okay, I'm listening. I'm going to do encryption and authentication. Before I encrypt a message, I will authenticate it, meaning I'm going to add some signature, something which is protecting the message against being forged. And then I'll encrypt the whole thing so nobody can understand it. And then on the other side, I'll decrypt the whole thing and then check. Is the signature valid? Is the authenticator valid? Whatever I'm using to protect against forgeries, I'm going to check that on the decryption side. Now, the problem with this is it's somehow the wrong way around. If you talk to cryptographers for the last 5 or 10 years about the right way to combine authentication and encryption, what they'll tell you is you should first encrypt and then authenticate. And when you're checking, you should verify and then decrypt. You can imagine, I mean, it seems like a trivial little thing, and I mean, why not do it this way? You should encrypt everything, right? There's even books from 5, 10 years ago which say do it exactly this way. And it's maybe possible to get this right. I think I can write something down which I believe is secure, which works this way of decrypting unauthenticated data and then checking whether it's a forgery. But there's so many ways to get it wrong. It's just incredible. And there's so many deployed systems that work this way that have been broken. One of the classic examples, 1998. This attack was stealing SSL plain text. I wrote here, steals SSL RSA ciphertext. Sorry, this should say plain text. So given a ciphertext for HTTPS, what this attacker was doing was figuring out the plain text by changing the ciphertext to a million different variants of it, sending all those variants to the server, and watching what the server did, where the server was decrypting and then checking for forgeries. And to understand how this happened, you have to look into what the server was doing in a little more detail. There was this RSA encryption where first SSL was decrypting that, and then saying, okay, there's supposed to be, when you encrypt a message in SSL with RSA, you're supposed to take the message, and it's not going to be exactly whatever, 2048 bits, whatever the right size is for RSA. So you're supposed to apply some padding system. And this padding is also supposed to protect against various kinds of RSA issues that people worry about. So you apply this standard padding mechanism, and it's not a bad padding mechanism. for taking a message and turning it into, say, 2048 bits for RSA encryption. And then you apply RSA encryption. On the decryption side, SSL undoes the RSA encryption and then checks, do I have this correctly padded message? And then it looks at the message, assuming that it's padded correctly. Then it looks at the message and says, aha, wait, I've also got inside the message, I've got an authenticator. I should check, is it a valid message? Nobody could forge the authenticator. The problem is that because of this PKCS padding, when you look at what the server does to variants of your ciphertext, Weichenbacher took this ciphertext and changed it in a way that made a predictable change to the RSA decrypted output. And by seeing what that predictable change did, how it interacted with the PKCS padding, he was able to figure out, oh, okay, the server's got a million forgeries, and then 1,000 of them it said, yes, that has valid PKCS padding for this one, this one, this one. And from that pattern, I know, because of the changes I've made in the ciphertext, I know what the plaintext is, what happens after RSA, which of the plaintext is correctly PKCS padded or not. That tells me exactly what's in the plaintext. Now, how could he make changes to ciphertext which did something predictable to the plaintext? Well, this is what RSA allows just by the structure of RSA. RSA is, you have some public key N, and you're supposed to compute some power, maybe the third power of your message, mod N. And then decryption is doing something which does a cube root mod N, say, or whatever the power is. Now, if you take your ciphertext and you multiply it by 8, and then you take the cube root, you get the cube root of your original ciphertext, your original plaintext, times the cube root of 8, which is your original plaintext times 2. So you can make a totally predictable change to the ciphertext, multiply it by 8, and that makes a totally predictable change to what happens before this padding check. It shifts it by 1 bit, multiplies it by 2. And there's a lot more details that go into this attack, but that's the basic idea, that because of this PKCS padding, sometimes saying yes, sometimes saying no for the decryption result, that would actually reveal what the plaintext was. Typically, people try to stop this attack by saying, okay, we're going to make the padding check integrated with the authentication check. Make sure that you can't tell whether you've had a padding failure or an authentication failure. So all your forgeries will be rejected. But nobody gets this right. Nobody. It's the sort of thing where theoretically I think it can be done, but it just keeps failing again and again and again. Some examples from 2009, 2011, 2012. 2009, recovery of SSH plaintext. Not all SSH plaintext, but some noticeable fraction of your SSH plaintext. You log into a machine and maybe your password is being revealed to this attack. Maybe some other part of your connection. But it's kind of scary that SSH, which is supposed to be the secure shell program, is revealing some small fraction of its plaintext to this attack. And the attack works very much like this. Another attack, if you SSL encrypt yes or SSL encrypt no, then well, they get padded to a longer length, and there's various options there. Maybe they're both padded to 48 bytes. Obviously, if you have a much longer message, then you can tell, yeah, it's much longer than 48 bytes. But you shouldn't be able to tell the difference between yes, encrypted, authenticated, padded to 48 bytes, and no, encrypted, authenticated, padded to 48 bytes. But this attack actually did tell the difference between yes and no, exactly because of another of these failures. And then this DTLS example, this is full DTLS plaintext recovery. DTLS is this datagram version of SSL, which you can use for more efficient SSL. And that, at least for the OpenSSL and GNU TLS information, because of this kind of attack with some timing information on the side, completely reveals the plaintext that you're sending along. The attacker takes a ciphertext, makes some little changes to it, sees how the server responds, and from that figures out what the plaintext was. All right, I had a couple slides on the 2011 attack, but maybe I'll skip past those in the interest of time and move on to bad cryptographic primitives. All right, sometimes if I hear people saying what's going wrong in cryptography, they'll focus entirely on this. Hey, RSA 768 was factored by an academic team 2 years ago. That means some cryptography has been broken. Don't use RSA 768. That's the most important advice you can get. Use RSA 1024 or 2048, something bigger than 768. Oh, DES was broken many years ago in the 1990s. Definitely don't use that. MD5, was broken kind of in 2004. And then, there was a forgery of a completely functional certificate in 2008, MD5-based certificate in 2008, where this was a completely standard protocol. These warnings somehow, when people are issuing these warnings about particular primitives being broken, they tend not to get into how did these primitives get used in the first place and then end up being broken. Talk about it as some matter of luck that, oh yeah, there's these cryptographic standards that, oh, somehow got broken. Like this MD5-based stuff, yeah, too bad that MD5 was broken. Nobody could have seen that happening. Or RSA 768, yeah, okay, we thought after 512, it was 10 years from RSA 512 being factored to RSA 768. Hardware gets better, algorithms get better. Yeah, you could predict that happening. That's why you should move to RSA 1024. Okay, people describe these things as, yeah, cryptanalysis is making these advances, but you can't really tell what's going to be broken next. I think the point where people turn off their brains looking at these bad cryptographic primitives is saying, well, somebody has standardized the cryptography that I'm using, like the US government standardized DES many years ago, didn't withdraw it until after it was very publicly broken. RSA 512 was standardized, RSA 768 was standardized, and whatever the standard is, people say, oh, there's a standard, so it must be secure. But if you actually look a little more at the details of these things, and you see, wait a minute, cryptographers, cryptanalysts, people like Bart, have actually been complaining many years earlier about a lot of these things, not all of them. In fact, the ones that the cryptanalysts were complaining about tend to be the ones that are broken. Like 1996, here's an exact quote. It is anticipated that these techniques can be used to produce collisions for MD5. And this was 8 years before Wang found collisions in MD5, more than 10 years before rogue CA certificates were constructed because of weaknesses in MD5. Now, standardization committees aren't actually, it's not the job of a standardization committee to make something secure. The job of a standardization committee is to settle on a standard. You got some companies that want to agree on a standard. Just like before there were antitrust laws, companies would get together to try to say, here's what the market should do. We don't want to compete. We want to settle on here's what the price should be of something. Here's what the standards should be. Let's stop wasting all this time fighting about stuff. Let's slow down the market and do something that makes us all happy. And that's what standardization committees are. They're trying to settle on something that some companies can all do, where security is not the main concern. What the companies are mainly concerned about is making money. And if they're standardizing cryptography, then they want the cryptography that will be the easiest to make money off of, which tends to be the cryptography that's the fastest, cryptography that is the least secure, and that's also got the most warnings from cryptographers. So I don't know where people get the idea that because something's been standardized, it's going to be secure. I also don't know where people get the idea that this is the biggest problem in cryptography. I'm spending this one slide on it. I'll say a bit more about speed later. But I think the other kinds of issues that I was mentioning are much more important for cryptographic users. All right, speed over security. Got just a few slides left, and let me just check how many minutes I've left. Okay, I think officially I have 5 minutes left, so that'll be enough for some speed comments. Cryptographic users sometimes have performance constraints, and a lot of times, because of those performance constraints, they're going to switch the cryptography they're using from something stronger to something that they know is weaker. Or something that, well, they don't know is weaker, but we can tell them, yeah, it's going to be weaker. For instance, RSA 1024. If you look at what cryptanalysts were publishing in, say, 2003, Shamir is the S in RSA. And he has a paper in 2003 saying, in 1 year, for $10 million with chip technology at that time, you can factor a 1024-bit RSA key. Now, as a result of that, the US government and the RSA company said, all right, by 2010, move to RSA 2048, which is why a year or two ago you can see a lot of banks and so on moving to RSA 2048. But a lot of sites are not moving to RSA 2048. It's a lot more expensive than RSA 1024. And because of those performance problems, Google, for example, is using 1024-bit RSA for their SSL web pages, not 2048-bit RSA. And there's even, you can find articles from people saying, here's why it doesn't make sense to use RSA 2048, here's the expense of it, here's here's the 10 times slower it would make the following web servers, and we care about this performance. So we can only use RSA 1024. Now, sometimes people will say it's just fine to use RSA 1024 because it's actually not breakable. Despite these articles saying, hey, $10 million 1 year, my data isn't worth $10 million. If it is, I'd like to know, but my data is not worth as much as somebody doing a 1024-bit factorization, so why would they bother? Some things to think about if you see this kind of comment from people trying to encourage you to reduce your cryptographic security levels. The first question is the attack actually so expensive? In 2003, if it was $10 million for a year, then what is it like in 2012 or 2013 or 2014, within the lifetime of whatever cryptographic system you have, maybe 2020? Is it still going to be $10 million or is it going to be some cheap $1,000 thing? The 512-bit RSA factorization, when it was done, was a supercomputer level factorization, a lot of work on a lot of computer power. And now it's something takes a couple months with software you download from the internet on one dual-core laptop. In a few years, it's going to be 512-bit is nothing, 1024-bit, okay, it'll still be kind of expensive for a while, but not super expensive. So got to watch out for hardware improvements, and maybe your data is not decreasing in value the same way that your 10-year-old computers are. Second thing to worry about, if you see somebody trying to quantitatively think about cryptanalysis costs, a lot of times the cryptanalysis can be spread across a lot of targets. And then any one target is not going to be broken faster, but maybe 10 targets can all be broken for the price of one, or 100 for the price of one. Or sometimes some of these acronyms I'm writing down here are things like, okay, you can break 1 million targets for the price of 1,000. Not the price of one, but also not the price of 1 million. Now, in these cases, well, if you're thinking how valuable is my data, you better adjust that by a factor of 1,000 to think about it from the attacker's perspective, if they can make it 1,000 times more cost-effective by attacking a lot of targets at the same time. And the third thing to think about is that a lot of times the attacker is not doing the same kind of economic analysis because the attacker is not buying the hardware that they're using for the attack. Conficker, the down-and-up worm, depending on the estimates, broke into something between 8 and 15 million computers around the internet. And that's a lot of computer power, which, as far as I know, was not used for cryptanalysis. But hey, if you want to do a big cryptanalytic project, it makes much more sense to do it this way than to buy the computation power yourself. Few more examples is my last slide, just people who are scaling down their cryptography because of performance problems. Tor, the anonymity network, which is advertising, they're doing everything they can to protect your communications, your anonymity of your communications against everybody. Well, they're using 1024-bit RSA, so anybody who has $10 million breaks it in a year, in 2003. Example three, DNSSEC. Maybe I've kicked DNSSEC enough already, but DNSSEC uses RSA 1024, and it's totally explicit about performance being the reason for it. It's the speed of the signatures in RSA 1024, the verification, and also the bandwidth used for 1024-bit RSA. OpenSSL, this is a different kind of speed example, not about RSA, but about AES, which I mentioned before. They've known for years that there's timing attack problems. And it is possible to write AES software, which doesn't do ifs with secret data and doesn't do secret array indices. But they're still using secret array indices because they don't want to slow down. On most CPUs, the fastest way to do AES uses X bracket I, where I is secret, and OpenSSL does not want to compromise their performance for the sake of security. And the last example, maybe the most depressing example, here's a site which has installed SSL, sourceforge.net. They host, I don't know, 100,000 collaborative source development projects. If you log into your account at SourceForge, you get an SSL connection. If you type HTTPS, I think if you type HTTP, they'll redirect you to SSL. So they've installed a sourceforge.net certificate. They've got everything working very smoothly. If you connect to sourceforge.net with HTTPS, but don't go to your account page, go to your develop page, you get a completely secure connection to the server, and then the server says, securely, please reconnect Here's a redirect to http sourceforge.net/develop. And then you make your HTTP connection, which means you're turning off the cryptography. Just because of the performance, they cannot handle all of their 100,000 projects developers logging in all the time. I haven't seen a statement from them saying this is a reason, but what else could the reason be? Why don't they have HTTPS just working for all their web pages, same way it's working for the account web page? Obvious explanation is performance. And there's tons and tons of sites like this where they have SSL working, but because of the performance problems, they turn it off. Now, everything else that I've said about cryptography failing, cryptography providing very little of the security that it's supposed to be providing, these examples, if you end up turning off the cryptography, then it doesn't matter how bad the cryptography is. You're obviously getting no benefit out of it. In the case of DNSSEC, maybe that's actually an advantage because then you don't get the denial of service problems and the confidentiality problems. But in any case, cryptography, obviously in all these examples, is not working very well. Thanks for your attention.